Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV. We will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I will provide you with guests and the information you're going to want to have whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now, let's move behind the scenes. At Movie Beat, the chat room is open. I want to welcome everyone who's in the chat room to listen today. My guest is Orly Ravid. She's a specialist in film acquisition and sales and distribution, and we're going to be talking to her in just a few moments. But first, I've got some announcements. I want to tell everyone thanks for tuning in, thanks for listening, thanks for your support, and for spreading the word about Movie Beat to your friends and your industry connections. Our Twitter address is RexSykesMovieBT. That's RexSykesMovieBT. If you're not yet following a Twitter, please do. And I always appreciate it when you tweet about my guests and retweet about these interviews, because it's our way of connecting with other filmmakers and other fans around the world, and we can do it through you and your efforts. If you post it on your Facebook wall, if you put it on your MySpace wall, or if you utilize any other form of social media, or you just simply email or call your friends and go, hey, guess who's on Movie Beat today? Or guess what? That same interview that you listened to live is available afterwards as an archive show at the official website. And that website address is rexsikes.com. That's right. It's my name, Rex Sykes. I'm your host. It's rexsikes.com. All of the interviews are archived at the interviews blog. When you go to the interviews blog, you'll click on interviews and it'll open up a faceplate of five different interviews. Pay no attention. It even says it right there. It says pay no attention to the dates that you see, because those are creation dates. Those are the dates that I created that particular blog piece, but it has nothing to do with the date of the interview. The date of the interview is actually inside the content there. So if you click on my guest name, for example, today it's Orly Ravid, you click on her link, it'll open up a biography page. And so you could read all about her, read about all of my different guests. And then inside that content, that biography, it will say upcoming. To listen live, click bolded link below, and it'll give you the date and the time, or it'll say to be announced. But you click the bolded link, it'll take you right to the live platform. And when you're at the live platform, you can make us a friend, you can make us a fan, you can join us in the chat room, which some of you are doing right now. But you can rate and review the show. And rating and reviewing the show also makes us more popular and allows us to reach more people. So please be sure to do that whenever you listen live. And all of the interviews are archived right there at RexSykes.com in that interviews blog. And you just go through, if it says to listen, and it doesn't say upcoming or to be announced, or it doesn't say live, then it's already happened. And you can listen to it right there from the website. Or you can subscribe to Rex Sykes Movie Beat, the podcast, from the iTunes store. Get them all downloaded to your favorite electronic device. Have it with you on the go, wherever you are, and listen to these experts share their secrets, their advice, their tips, their methods, their practices, their principles, their philosophies to help you succeed. Because that is what it is really about. Movie Beat is designed to be a resource for you. That's why I connect you up with professionals who are making it happen. Now, you can subscribe to the official website at RexSykes.com by clicking on the RSS feed right there at the welcome page, and that way you'll always be updated to the changes. If you do subscribe to the podcast at the iTunes store, please go ahead and rate and review the podcast just as you would right now listening live. Again, it extends our reach. And again, please continue to tweet about us, Facebook it. You can join the Facebook friends group or the group right there from my profile in Facebook. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here. I got just one or two announcements on top of that. Kevin Sorbo Celebrity Golf, A World Fit for Kids, is a charity that's coming up June 10th and 11th. I've been talking about it for the past year. It's in Las Vegas. If you like kids, if you like golf, if you like charity, if you like celebrities, if you like Las Vegas, this is the place for you. Go to the Hot and Fun blog at RexSykes.com and read all about it. It is about the fourth item down or fifth item down there at the Hot and Fun blog, And check that out, please, because it is an important charity for children. And also, I got a screener from Paul Prevenza. Paul's going to be my guest tomorrow, live, June 4th. You got to check my website, check the interviews to for that time, or look at Twitter or Facebook. It's 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Pacific, and where it is around the world is based on those calculations. Anyway, Paul Prevenza is a writer, a producer, a director, a comic, an author. He's come out with a new book, Satiristas. He's got a new show. They sent me the screener. It's on Showtime. It debuts on the 10th of June, and that is The Green Room with Paul Prevenza. He's my guest tomorrow. You're going to want to see this show. His first show that I watched had Drew Carey, Eddie Izzard, Larry Miller, and other comics, including Paul. And they sit around, they talk about comedy, they talk about show business, they talk about methods of comedy. I'm excited about the show, and I think you will be too, so I want to tell you about it. Paul is very up next as my guest, so you're going to want to tune in for that live. All right, well, enough said. It's time to get into this discussion with my guest. And my guest is Orly Ravid. And I have a sneaking suspicion that this is the first of a number of interviews with Orly, because as she would tell you, the industry is changing, and so there's certainly reason to talk more about this. But the subject is deep, it's vast, it's broad, and I'm glad to have someone like Orly here to discuss it. She's a co-executive director of the Film Collaborative. And she works primarily on distribution, sales, licensing, contract negotiation services with a focus on new media digital distribution. She also handles theatrical releases. She's a 10-year veteran whose experience in film ranges from festival programming to acquisition and domestic licensing and distribution, as well as business affairs and foreign sales. So she is the person that we're going to be talking to right now. Hi, how are you, Orly?
I'm well. I'm grateful that you said my name correctly. Thank you so much. So few people do. I really appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, we talk, you know, nuts and bolts filmmaking. We talk pre-production. We talk production. We talk post-production. We talk distribution. But there's so many facets to being in the film business or show business, TV, webisodes, all the kind of stuff. And I'm so happy to have you here so that we can discuss you know, because once a filmmaker makes their film and they've got that, in the old days, celluloid, now they've got a digital DVD or they've got some method of, they've got some tangible product that they could put either on the internet or in a theater or on television, whatever. But there's a lot that goes on once that product is now completed, and we get to talk to you about that, and that's what thrills me, and to find out more about that. So, as we begin, I think I said sales and negotiation. I said acquisition and distribution. Those are some of the components to getting a film sold and picked up and into the theaters. Could you kind of describe each of those facets, and then afterwards, I'm going to ask you to walk us through this process.
Sure. I mean, the facets that you listed that I do with the organization are facets that I've done in the for-profit world. So I've done the foreign sales and the acquisitions and the business affairs and all that stuff. So, you know, after a film is finished and filmmakers and producers and their investors and everyone involved wants the film to be seen and wants the film to recoup its investment and the whole shebang, the parts are there's almost inevitably some level of licensing and foreign sales, at least until digital distribution has truly replaced everything else, until the television and the internet completely collapse into themselves and become one. There's going to be, and there may always be a level of licensing simply because of the complexities of distributing around the world and needing to have marketing partnerships around the world. But to say nothing of the need for subtitling or dubbing, as the case may be. But so foreign sales is one piece, and I started out actually in the late 90s, so it's, I guess, a little over 10 years now of working, doing foreign sales. And, you know, in the 80s, it was a really, really big business. Companies made lots and lots of money as home video was new, and rights were sold. And to be honest, it wasn't so much about art film at the time. It was really a lot about genre film, action film, horror film, all that kind of stuff. It sold very, very well. markets such as the AFM and, at the time, MiFID in Italy and Milan, which is no longer, and in Cannes at the market, and at the television markets like MIPCOM and stuff, and MIPTV. So that issue, that involves selling the rights to territories around the world and, you know, making, at the time, lots and lots of money. And, of course, these days it's less so. Although, you know, well, and also then in the 90s, films like The Celebration, you know, winning the Palme d'Or, sold within that same Cannes market to 30 territories around the world. So it also obviously in the 90s started to happen for art films and there are companies like Cellular Dreams and Fortissimo that have become world-class film financiers by virtue of doing pre-sales and just their ability to sell art. And in fact, those companies focus on art films. So the art film market really caught up to some extent, the genre market in terms of being very viable from a business perspective in the 90s. And so there's all that, right, that comes that can happen for films. It's a bit hard for really, really so-called small American indies that don't have cast. And it's, obviously, everything is harder now these days than it was in the 80s and the 90s. The acquisitions game that I've done, you know, I worked for Wolf and I worked for Senator prior to going bankrupt, which we can talk about if you want, one of my favorite topics. You know, that's just the game of people being chosen to scout festivals for films and buy films for the distributors in the territory. I mean, if you're like a Matt Brodley who works for Paramount, you're sometimes buying for English-speaking world or for the world as a whole, or sometimes you're just buying for the United States and Canada, North America, you know, that's what we call it. So it depends, you know, there are different buyers who go to markets like some of the ones that I mentioned and other ones, there are many, many of them, to buy films. And so I have experience in both of those facets of the business, and I did a ton of business affairs work as well at the companies that I referenced, including the foreign sales one, which is Amazing Movies and Holland Crest Pictures, and Picture This. And so I brought that experience to launching a nonprofit, just sort of knowing the nuts and bolts of the traditional stuff, including having done home video A to Z. I mean, literally, like, overseeing everything related to manufacturing, replication, and the authoring, and the marketing, and the sales, and obviously all the theatrical. And I sort of cut my teeth on my own theatrical business when I released Besmois, which was at the time broke some box office records and a little bit of a scandalous release in the States. But these are the sort of more traditional components to the business, the buying and selling, as it were, of rights per territories. And we could talk about that for an hour if you wanted. But what have I not answered? Because I think there's some other little bits to your question.
Yeah, and we probably will spend different hours on different topics because you're right. I mean, you could talk just about the sales alone. But let's back up and take it kind of a step by step. When somebody has I have a movie and I'm trying to sell it. What are some of the components right in the early stage that I need to know as the filmmaker or the person who has the rights to the project? And what is it I'm trying to sell? Who am I trying to sell it to? And then what eventually happens? I mean, ultimately, it's going to be negotiated with somebody, and we'll talk about that too. But what's kind of the first step out of the gate with my completed project?
It's a really big question, so I'm going to take my time to answer it. The first thing is, if you're the director, the filmmaker, the creative behind the project, your goals and agenda may be distinct or different from whoever invested their money into it. Even if you're the one who invested money into it, there's the goal of having a career connected to the film or spinning off of the film. So there's the one piece of making sure that the film gets positioned in the best way possible. It gets sent to the best festivals. The best decision is made around which festival it should have its premiere. The marketing is done before that happens. I mean, I think the most common mistake made by filmmakers is that they don't even think about the audience, the market, building a brand and an awareness around the film until it's too late. It should happen before the festival for these reasons, actually, because it's no longer black and white about whether or not you should hope to sell your film at Sundance or any other festival. You may sell it, you may not sell it. You may do a hybrid thing of selling it and some of your own distribution. And there needs to be a game plan going into the festival, you know, addressing the various contingencies and already having developed a fan base and an awareness in the media and just with audiences and sort of grassroots and social network marketing level around your film. Because, it, first of all, that will already help you in the marketplace just from a pure traditional way of selling your film, should you do so, to television or for an all rights or whatever happens. And it'll also obviously set you up better for distributing film and giving you a better opportunity to work off of what happens at the festival in distribution. So there's the analysis that has to happen, and every film is different. And so the case studies that, you know, we're developing are going to show all kinds of examples, films that sell completely to, you know, in a more traditional way, films that, you know, do it only the DIY way, and films that do a hybrid. And I think that's the analysis where you've got to ask yourself, how many professionals am I going to work with? Because now not think just about the filmmaker getting his or her film seen by audiences, and also knowing that a film that gets distributed that's perceived to have done well, or that has some sort of critical clout or whatever other commerciality that is going to matter to other executives, that person's filmmaking career is more likely to go forward. They're more likely to get hired to do other projects or get funding for their next project or get television gig, whatever it is that they're pursuing. So, I mean, there's all sorts of details around that, right? The agenda behind it for the director to get work further and to have a career that's developed. But then there's also the business of recouping the investment of the film, paying back investors, and those agendas connect, because then obviously those investors are more likely to fund your next project. Just like Precious, I mean, the investors behind Precious didn't make money behind his first film that they invested in, but then they did obviously behind Precious, so they're going to back the next, I'm sure. You know, there's the question of, well, do you need a producer's rep and a sales agent and a lawyer and, you know, you got to, obviously we're trying to collapse the need for so many middlemen and streamline that whole process and not have people waste money, which, you know, I think they often do, which we can talk about. That's another hour conversation on how to make those decisions around.
Let's just assume we're going to have 20 hours or so.
Okay, so we keep going. Well, you know, I mean, look, I don't think people should – I don't believe in companies like Page Austro or Austrian company that take 10 or 11 or 14 grand. I have to look it up exactly to help you find a sales agent. I don't believe in that. I don't believe in actually the whole producer's rep thing getting paid up front. I mean, I'm going to say that right now, and I'm going to make a few enemies, and I'm fine with that. I don't believe that people need to be paid up front in any serious sum. It's one thing to, you know, for example, Festival Indies wants you to pay them a fee to take your film to the conferences where all the college bookers are. Okay, there's some sort of modest expenses there that they don't want to front, and that's a different example. I understand that if there's like some very small token fees up front, perhaps, but nothing, you know, to cover some basic expenses, maybe. But the truth is, any person or a company that believes that they can help you make money should simply earn their keep or earn their opportunity to do so by making a small piece of the money that they bring you. So if you're going to go with a traditional sales agent, which sometimes you shouldn't, sometimes you shouldn't, we can discuss when and, you know, when that is the case, that entity should be recouping expenses that are capped and defined and not, you know, fancy yachts and fancy dinners. And they should take a reasonable fee. No, but I mean, this is serious. I mean, I've seen really scandalous. I mean, first of all, they're companies that I even like and really respect from in terms of their pedigree, where I see their sales reports, and it's like they made $500,000 in sales, and the people on the other end got $15,000. Well, it doesn't. What's the point of having done all those sales if the investors don't get their money back? Like, who cares if the company did all those sales if the people who need the money back don't get it? What's the point?
Well,
so
I agree with you 100%. I just want to say a couple of things. I want you to continue and hold your thought. Don't worry. No, the first is that I think that the filmmaker has they do have tertiary responsibility to their investors first and foremost to try and pay them back and or pay them back plus something. And you touched on that with the idea that, you know, hopefully people will invest in you again. And if the relationship is right, even if you don't make money that first time, they may still come back and invest with you, as the example you cited with Precious. But that's assuming that you're a good business person and you're taking care of the people and you're taking care of the investors so that they still want to invest with you, even if they didn't make money the first time. And not all investors, you know, are naive enough to think that they're going to make money the first time. You know, I mean, there's a whole gamut of people out there. Secondly, I'm a producer. And I know that as a producer, I'm often the last person to get paid. After the investors get paid, after everybody else gets paid, I'm the last person to see a dime of the movie. And so when you talk about producers' reps or film reps or sales agents taking money up front, I got to agree with you. You know, they can back end it like I do or like anybody else does or like the people who are expecting to get paid. I firmly agree with you that there's too much upfront costs that oftentimes vanish, and then other people don't make anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, actually, I just touched on all this on my most recent blog post that I did, I think, yesterday. I mean, first of all, it is the most expensive art medium in the world. And if you've chosen to work within it, unless you're getting grants and unless you're working in a way that really is clearly not about recouping investment, if anyone else, you know, thinks that they're getting their money back, it does behoove you to make that happen. And, you know, one of the reasons that I started the nonprofit is that in the other space that I was in, I was shocked by how many people were making money out of filmmaking except for the people investing in it. So all these other people make money and have a really nice lifestyle traveling around the world to festivals and markets and owning, starting to own films, and they get all the power because now they have libraries of films and rights, and the people who invest in the films don't have the rights anymore. And seeing more and more of these reports from companies where, you know, so $70,000 in sales and the filmmaker got $2,000. Like whatever it was, whatever the ridiculous numbers played out, it was silly. And I just felt like, you know what, it should be service-based. It just, I don't believe in the rights thing, except that we still have to play that game sometimes, and we can discuss why that is the case.
Sure.
But I really, the organization that I started and co-run with my business partner, Jeffrey Winter, is all about not taking rights and getting paid for our time, not for ownership of the content, and just treating it like a service business where we're performing services. And I do believe people should be paid for the time. It's a tremendous amount of work, but we really do it in a very low fee way because we want to change. We want to like, you know, I'll be happy when we're no longer needed and we're no longer serving a purpose, because I want the entire industry to shift. And I think it will, by the way. I think it will. It'll have to, at least for a whole class of films, maybe not
wow.
for the A-list films, but I think there's too many people now ready to work with the films and ready to work with filmmakers in a different way, where the old school model isn't going to work anymore. I do think we're going to see some of the less capable and less honest sales companies go by the wayside, and some of those ridiculous producer reps go by the wayside, and I think that old fat cat model isn't going to last too much longer. But
wow.
That's just my thought.
Now, before we get into what model might replace it and what's going to happen, let's go back. We're talking about the sale of the film. What does the savvy business filmmaker need to have in place in order to even begin to potentially sell their film? What are there certain deliverables that they need to pay attention to? Or what, you know, I mean, in other words, from your vantage point, what should they have to help the process? Now, you've said, which I agree with, and we've had John Reese on the other day and before and other people, you know, about this advanced marketing, start in pre-production if you can or earlier or at least in the production to make sure that you brand and get yourself out there. But now, and connect with your audience and have an audience. So what's going to make the sale first smoother and easier, you know, and then we could talk about maybe what's going to make the sale more appealing. You know, because everybody has the same thing, you know, I mean, in terms of what they have to deliver, then what's the difference that makes the difference, you know, in terms of attracting someone? And maybe you can help us out with that.
Sure. I mean, some of the basics are, and this doesn't apply for films that aren't going to sell no matter what happens, because then they're just wasting money creating these deliverables. But you do need, first of all, you need everything cleared. I mean, you have to have everything cleared, your music and your footage and whatever else is in your film. And then, you know, if you're going to do distribution worldwide, there's going to be, and your film is big enough to merit, you know, sales and the proper deliverables, then you're going to need to have your dialogue list for the subtitling and also separated M&E tracks, you know, and proper channels so that dubbing can be done if if you sell to those territories where there is dubbing and your film is big enough that the distributors are going to bother paying for that, because that is a reality still in the world. And you obviously need lots of photography and high res images that are marketable, that are usable. That's going to both be a requirement in the numbers, and it's also going to set you apart especially if you have good key art and good trailer. Any marketing that you're going to provide the marketplace, like marketing starts with the marketplace. So if you want your films to sell well, you need to sort of already position the film and create a sense that the film is going to be able to sell. Doesn't mean that distributors around the world aren't going to have their own spin on it for their own cultures and their own sense of what sells well, but you got to give them something to work off of. The more extra features you have for Blu-rays, because Blu-ray is sort of what's, helping save the biz a little bit on the DVD side in the short term, that kind of stuff. But, I mean, the key is, obviously the bigger the films, like when I was a senator, I mean, we had to have everything textless and texted and all that stuff for the big foreign deals. But, I mean, I think if once you're in that world, you're already talking about films that are, the millions in terms of the budget, and you have post supervisors and you have a sales company that's going to give you a laundry list of what you need to provide, and you're going to have to do all that. So that's probably another game that I'm not sure you're referring to, but yeah, I would say that a lot of filmmakers get really screwed by not having thought about this in time, and then it becomes extremely expensive to start to try to create, like even just to get some basic deals. They don't have proper deliverables. These days people want an HD master. I mean, they want the highest quality master. And sometimes people don't have that. And so that's an unfortunate waste. Does that make sense?
It's excellent. I mean, the more that, some people obviously know what they need, and other people who may be listening don't know yet, or they do now.
They can always email me or call me, and I'll give them different lists from sales companies. But they're different for every company in terms of the complete list of deliverables, and they're pages and pages long. I mean, all sorts of sound elements and the formats change. It was D88 once, and now it changes. So you want to keep up before you make your film. You want to make sure if your film is such that it might actually sell around the world, you might want to get a current list before you go ahead and make it.
Awesome. Very cool. Now, let me say that your website is thefilmcollaborative.org. Thefilmcollaborative.org is your website, and they can find out more from you there, or they might be able to email you through the website. Is that correct?
And also I'm Orly at thefilmcollaborative.org. So O-R-L-Y at the Film Collaborative.
Awesome. Well, we thank you for that. Orly, I'm going to take a short break to remind the listeners that they are listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat with Orly Ravid today. The official website is rexsykes.com. That's my name, rexsikes.com. And again, please, you could be tweeting about us right now or retweeting these interviews while we're live. But do share my guests, share the information that you're getting with others by making it available through your favorite social media means, whether that's Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, or whatever. Certainly appreciate when you do that. My upcoming guest I've talked to you about already is Paul Provenza, producer, director, actor, comedian. I'm going to ask him how he manages to do it all. I think that will be my first question for him. He's acted in multiple series at the same time while directing and producing and writing. He's come out with a new book. I mean, he must be a man on massive amounts of coffee. Michael Kaplan is a feature filmmaker, Michael Kaplan is a feature film and documentary filmmaker. He is also an educator. He's began his career in the 90s as a producer of independent films in the Chicago area, and he will be coming up after Paul does. And then Peter Broderick will be joining us. He is the man who is responsible, I believe, for the term hybrid methods of distribution. Peter will be talking more on that subject. He's a distribution strategist. And so we are pleased to have so many fantastic guests on Movie Beat. Please let the world know, because it benefits my guests, and it benefits me, obviously, when you share my guests' But givers get. So when you give this away, you'll get something nice in return from the universe, that's for sure. All right, back to Orly. How you doing, Orly?
I'm great.
Cool. So I know that we haven't even begun to exhaust this, but the second part of this is that now they have their deliverables and they have what's required, and those requirements are shifting and changing, but they have them. What now happens? It's kind of like I have everything under my arm, and I try and find a producer's rep, I try and find a sales rep, I try and get an attorney, you know, as we were discussing before. What is the next step in this process, and whether or not we go with those particular individuals, or I go the festival route, or I do, at some point we're going to enter into, somebody's going to look at it and go, yeah, I might be interested, and then there's a negotiation process occur. But can you, again, baby step us through what's going to happen now that I've got everything?
And first of all, I don't think that, I think it's not really the case anymore that people should have the lawyer and the producer's rep and the sales agent. So I think the first thing is to do is to figure out what kind of film you are. And what kind of film business you expect from your film based on the reality, not wishful thinking. I think it's important to get clear. For example, it pained me as much as I really, you know, love, you know, the people at some of these sales companies. It also pains me to see sometimes films sell to IFC through a sales agent, only because IFC's buying enough and not unwilling to buy direct from filmmakers, and if your film is the kind of film that's going to sort of top out at selling it to IFC, then maybe do that deal directly, or do that deal with an expert, quote unquote, helping you, but in a different format, in a different way. Because the thing is, like, I don't want to see filmmakers give up their rights to a sales company who then is going to do a deal like that. And so much money is going to be cut out. I want to see filmmakers do deals directly, you know, whenever they can. And so I think you've got to kind of ask yourself, what kind of film am I? Am I a film that really actually might sell for 6 or 7 figures? There are not too many of those. So am I really that film? And maybe I'm going to do something different for the U.S. and Canada, and get someone to help me do deals, but not necessarily give up my rights to them. But I'll get a sales agent for the rest of the world, because there is. I mean, we do world sales, and we're also working with Ariel Veneziano, who's a veteran foreign sales guy. And obviously, you know, there's plenty of other companies and services that do that. That's a whole specific ballgame that you probably can't do completely by yourself, because it does involve going to markets. It does involve knowing who the right buyers are. There's, you know, countries around the world that you're really not going to be able to access. But I don't know that it makes sense for the U.S. I think you've got to know when you're going to your festival, really what are the realistic things to expect for your film, and try to find, in my opinion, try to find a way of doing business that doesn't involve you giving up your rights to someone or giving them a big fat cut, because it may just be 50 grand or no grand that you get, you know, from your deal. And now you're going to have whatever revenues you do get go through another party that you didn't necessarily need. I mean, buyers are going to come to you just as much, and I think that one needs to really get realistic about that, as well as to have your hybrid distribution plan in place. You know, there are plenty of films that are going to do way better through a DIY or hybrid strategy than they are through distribution, or there's very specific things that they're going to be better served by doing it through distribution versus not. And one needs to talk to enough players to get a real sense of, you know, what those films are, and I mean, and where their film falls into that whole range. You know, there's so many deals that were done at festivals that weren't actually real deals. They were service deals, or they were no advance deals. And tons of rights were given away for no good reason. There are times when, and this is the role that we're playing very carefully, right? Because I don't want to alienate good buyers, because we do believe in them for the right films and for the right deals. But we're also very aware of the fact that sometimes filmmakers are their own best distributors, and films can do the college circuit and the educational market and do an alternative theatrical and, you know, non-theatrical all by themselves, and do DVD distribution on their own, as well as do, you know, sales through maybe a service partner where they don't have to give up their rights and get, you know, have the best of both worlds. Be their own distribution platform as well as connect up with all the most traffic distribution platforms and, you know, work through maybe someone like Jeff Rosen at Breakthrough. You know, so there's, I guess what I'm trying to say is you got to really know where your film falls and have a plan that's going to best monetize your film so that you can pay back your investors and not just hand over all your rights to one party or, God forbid, you know, even two or three parties removed from you so, you know, you don't really see money again. Makes no sense.
Well, awesome. I appreciate that. I would like to back up a little bit and define two terms that you used that people, some obviously will be familiar with and others won't, and then I have a follow-up question after the definitions. But a service deal or a no advance deal?
Okay. So a service deal, which happens way more than people think, when you see freestyle releasing, let's say, associated with a film, that's always a service deal.
Let me stop you right there. Freestyle releasing, what is meaning what?
That's a company. So, like, let's say you're the kind of filmmaker who opens up Variety and looks at the gross, at the box office grosses behind a movie, and you see that Freestyle releasing was the distributor of a film. When that's the case, they were paid to do the work. There's nothing wrong with that. Strand releasing, which is a distributor of many wonderful art house films. Some of the films that they release are service deals. Some of the films lots of distributors do are service deals. And service deal means the distributor was paid to do the release. Roadside Attractions does that a lot. And we work with them too. I mean, this is not a bad thing. I'm just saying be careful of what you read, or rather be careful of how you interpret what you read. Because it's not necessarily the case that those films were given money for the rights, or that there was some wonderful deal. It is the case that they often will have financed the release of the film, and they will have paid for the services. And we, you know, listen, we do that. We provide that service in terms of, you know, doing releases for folks instead of taking their rights. So I'm not condemning the model. What I am saying, though, is there's all these press releases around deals done, and they're not always what you think. They're not always the case that a company plunk down a bunch of cash and, you know, the investors are now made whole and everyone's happy. No, some of the times the investors are actually plunking down more cash to get the film released in the hopes of making the money back later, which may happen. I mean, there are plenty of releases that works out very well. Freestyle, for example, I mean, I don't know them that well, but, you know, they have a good relationship with Fox on Video. It could be that millions of dollars are plunked down toward releasing a horror film through them. The movie goes out theatrically, and then the money comes back from home video. So this is not – I'm not saying bad things about anything. But I do want people to get clear. And then the no-advance deal, there are – you know, distributors are hurting. So there are plenty of distributors who, in fact, may be very good distributors. But they're doing deals at Sundance or wherever else, and they're not actually paying money. They're just doing a contract, and they're going to now keep the rights and distribute the film. And I'm not saying that that's always a bad thing. You know, we've done deals for filmmakers, and I can give examples where we chose, instead of getting a low advance, we chose to have no advance but a much better back end, and we're obviously, I believe, we're very good in terms of contract negotiations and protecting the filmmaker so that they'll have better overages. They'll get more royalty in the back end, and, you know, if you know the company and you feel very confident about your deal, you might go there. So, again, it's not like I'm not writing prescriptions here of do this, don't do this. I'm just saying it's not always what it seems. It's not like – it's not, you know, there was a concern that the business was going down and there weren't so many deals done at Sundance, and all of a sudden there were all these deals being announced. Not all those deals are the deals that you think they might be, the 5- and 6-, 7-figure deal up front. And sometimes they are, but it's a rarer thing these days is the point.
So you're saying that there's spin inside the motion picture – releasing this.
Did I say that? Oh.
Maybe you didn't. Maybe that's. But this is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. We've got about 18 minutes left. So again, I'll remind the listeners that we'll have you back. We're going to schedule it, you know, after we get off the show today, and we'll keep the announcements. We'll let you know. Always check back to the website, because then or listen to, you know, each upcoming show to find out when Orly will be back, and as well as the other guests. But the question I have is, going back now, again, I have my bundle under my arm, at least, you know, metaphorically, or, you know, the idea that I have my film and my rights and everything. I've got my where do I go? I'm a filmmaker. I'm sitting at home in Los Angeles or in the Midwest or in the South. I've got this completed project. And I mean, do I just like open up Variety and go, okay, here's the festivals and or look for a list of distribution companies and start sending out letters? What does the smart
Don't do that.
So what does the smart young, and by young I don't mean chronologically young, I mean the new filmmaker do to get the people who are going to be the best people for them to get the best deal they might possibly get? How do they get their film acquired? How do they get it sold and acquired and maybe make some money? So what's the first step? I've got it. Now, where do I go with it?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I know that there are all sorts of lists out there of buyers and distributors and sales agents, and, you know, people like Stacy Park provide those lists, and they're also, a lot of them are quite free at various markets, and you don't need to necessarily pay for them. And we have those lists, and I think the last thing one needs to do is, like, write cold letters, and, I mean, you're going to get nowhere pretty fast, and you'll also spend a lot of time and money doing that. You know, I think, again, you have to say, what's my film? Okay, my film, I believe the audience is such and such, and don't tell me it's the whole world, because it isn't. Get clear and get niche about it, and then liken your film to a few other films that you think you could really kind of mimic in terms of release, and then see who distributed those films. Obviously, I believe that we're a good resource. Call us. We'll give you what we think is the good information for you. Call whomever else you've heard about from your friends who are good, or whoever released the films that you compare your film to, and just start comparing notes, because people are going to have opinions about which festivals you can get into, which festivals you can't get into. You don't want to necessarily go with just one person or one company's opinion, but start to, I mean, there are different people out there who get paid money to consult, and, you know, Peter Broderick is one of those folks, and obviously we're one of those folks, and start to compare information and do some research on your own based on the films that you're comparing your film to, unless it's a film like no one's ever seen before. I mean, you know, The Banksy film, Exit Through a Gift Shop, is a very unique film. And, you know, they turned down $1 million offer at Sundance because they could, because Banksy already has 14,000 followers on Facebook and doesn't need to give up his rights to a film. So, and obviously they were working with John Slott. You know, so if you're like that, then you're one kind of film. And if you're a tiny film that's in the next section at Sundance, you're a different kind of film. It doesn't mean that you're not going to do business. It doesn't mean you don't have traction. Obviously, Bass Ackwards, you know, did some business and had some traction, and other films did too. It's just, you know, different films have different potentials, and the biggest dilemma is figuring out, okay, which festival can I get into? How should I handle that? And to what extent? I mean, I think the biggest dilemma people had going into Sundance, a festival like that, I bring up a lot because it's a festival that's so known for the deals happening out of it, and also is now bringing distribution opportunities to filmmakers, and the filmmakers have to ask themselves, you know, to what extent do I avail myself of the distribution opportunities at the festivals, either through the festival or directly or both, versus licensing rights. And it isn't just one answer. It really, really isn't just one answer. And you've got to talk to people like myself and whoever else you get into contact with to give you some perspective. There are people who are known to do good television sales, like David Garber and Meyer Schwarzstein. Josh Braun is a great sales agent. From Submarine, so, you know, I'm giving some free publicity and marketing to people who do what we do, but, you know, that it's a, you know, but we believe in that. I mean, so, you know, talk to those folks and get some perspective. But above all, I think if I can give any advice, really, everything can be negotiated, everything, and I mean right down to, let's say you want a sales agent help, but you don't want them to make a big fat cut if your sale is only such and such, or you don't want them to necessarily take as big of a cut from an IFC deal as they would from a deal with Fox Searchlight or Sony Pictures Classics. We'll negotiate that too. We believe in that. We believe in the kind of custom tailored arrangements based on the real world, where it shouldn't be the case that everyone else makes money from your film except for you.
Well, I got a question. How is it possible? I mean, in other words, I understand if you're helping the process, but I'm this filmmaker and I'm out there and I've got my film and I've, you know, got in a festival or maybe it's getting some attention or whatever, and you say everything is negotiable, you know, but the bottom line is I have this film and somebody kind of wants it. You know, they don't have to have it, but they kind of want it. What leverage do I actually have? I mean, I don't really have much bargaining strength, do I? I'm a newbie with a film, and I say, oh, well, I want to hold on to my rights for selling the DVDs, or I want to hold on to this, or I want to hold on to this. How do I negotiate, or is it best just to get someone to negotiate for me because they're gonna know how to speak the language first off, and know what's important to the people who are buying it, and you know. Because I don't see how I have an advantage over the people who might wish to have my film.
Well, look, I mean, you might if you have a film that feels like, you know, a Blair Witch or, you know, whatever. If you have a Paranormal Activity and you have an enormous following already online, you might not need anyone's help. At the same time, getting someone else's help to know how far you can push that might be worth the commission you're going to pay them. So I think it also depends on how much of a business person you are, and you know that yourself. If you're, you know, some filmmakers are really freaked out by doing that business work, and some filmmakers are very comfortable with it. I think one knows who one is. But I can say this. Selling at a market is critical. I mean, the price does go down afterward unless you really are holding something that, you know, and buyers talk. Everyone, it's a very small community. Buyers and sellers, everyone knows, you know. So there's a level at which having a professional involved helps, because as soon as your film is associated with that entity, assuming that they're trusted and liked and have a good reputation, the price goes up by virtue of already having that in play, and that already sort of is a stamp of approval. Yeah, this is valuable. There's going to be competition, and that, I mean, I remember being a buyer and, you know, dealing with people like Josh Braun, and you know, it already tells you, oh, you know, the film has some legs. At the same time, sellers can't make buyers buy what they don't want, you know, right. And people do talk. And I just think, again, you have to know, I think it's both things are true. I think on the one hand, you can benefit from working with a professional. On the other hand, you can also not need them if you have any comfort level, you know, in handling some of the deals yourself and just getting some perspective on the value of the film and the way to do the deal. But there are nuances. I mean, there is an importance in recognizing how far you can push a deal and how far you can push a distributor and when it's in your best interest to do so or not to do so. You know, when you might be actually giving up an interesting revenue stream that you can't generate yourself. I mean, there is a level at which, you know, the distributors do have access to the aggregation of audiences in some cases that you might not. And getting onto Walmart might be a very important thing for you that you can't necessarily do on your own. So I think it's a very custom thing, and I think you need to have enough conversations to get some perspective and to help make a decision. And that's what we exist for. I mean, we exist to talk to you for a year solid for $350. You can talk to us for a full year about all this stuff. So, you know, that's not a huge price to pay to get some perspective about the marketplace, for example.
No, it's an incredible bargain. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the answer. And also, very early in that answer, you said something that I think points back to what you said before and what other people have said in terms of the importance of connecting with your audience and building your audience and having, you know, a lot of people who are following you. If you've got a good product, and I mean, you can have the best product in the world, and it can remain on a shelf and not be sold unless it's marketed well. And one of the ways of I think incredible marketing nowadays is what's happening in social media and word of mouth. And when you've got, you know, a mailing list, or you've got a dialogue going between you and your audience, the larger that platform you have built from pre-production on, the more interest people will take in your film. If they know that there's 250,000 people out there who are opposed to, or that are excited about your movie, and that they could convert those to ticket sales or DVD sales or to buy, you know, T-shirts, they have a whole lot more interest in making the deal than if it's just you and your movie.
Yeah, and it gives you so much leverage. I mean, then you can really, you know, write in a way for you to do some of the direct distribution perhaps. I mean, you really, that's just, you're all about the win there. If you've already done that work and you're bringing that to the table, you're just going to create better opportunities for yourself all the way around.
And hence the reason why to start it early and not delay it, you know, and to figure out the best way to do it. Pardon me?
It takes time. It takes time to do that work. I mean, it should be done like 6 months before you exhibit your film publicly, if you can. And if it's not 6 months, then at least make it 3 months, something ahead of time, before your first exhibition. If you're just starting to think about it after your first exhibition, it's too late. I mean, you can still do it, and you should do it as soon as you can, but it's not ideal.
Now, we have about 8 minutes, maybe 7 minutes left. And again, you know, we'll come back and talk. Much more. But you said something, too, that I want to kind of follow up on with the question, you know, that buyers talk and it's a small community. So if you've got a buzz going with it, you want to ride that buzz while it's happening, because otherwise it fizzles and there's not as much dollars coming after the fizzle. So taking advantage of that, you know, again, it's got to be buzzworthy. I mean, if you've got a hollow product, it's not going to have buzz around it. So assuming that you've got this buzzworthy product, how do you create even more buzz? I mean, what do you recommend for the filmmaker to?
It's a great question. I mean, I think there's two kinds of buzz. There's industry buzz, and I think sometimes filmmakers spend a little too much time just focusing on that. You know, getting a publicist or getting, you know, doing people, helping them with their marketing just from the inside industry point of view. And I think that's important and useful if you're just thinking about selling your film. But again, we talked about the whole point was building your awareness to the public so that to the extent that you're doing your own distribution or even to the extent that you're selling rights and hoping that you see overages, the public needs to know about your film. And, you know, if you're already going to a top festival, they're doing publicity for your film, or the film is getting publicity because it's at the festival and you're hiring, you've hired a publicist, which is very critical. And so, you've got to try to time things close together and not just think about, you know, getting into variety, but getting, you know, having the public be aware of you. Depending on the kind of film you are, there's all sorts of publicity. It's not just film-related. If the films are tapping into certain niches or certain lifestyle interests, there's that sort of publicity. And to have everything timed right so that when your film, so that you can ride that wave and have your film be available for consumption in as many platforms as possible so that you can actually have decent business. And I think that's a tricky thing, and I think that takes a lot of coordination. And that's why the evaluation is so important, to figure out the extent to which you're doing that as close to its first exhibition as possible. Or if you have to hold because you're now going to sell your film and you're going to let your distributor do it, but you've got to know what you're doing and why. But publicists are important. I mean, and that's something that we don't do in-house, and we work with a number of different publicity firms, and they're all the ones we work with are all good in different ways for different kinds of films, and you've got to shop for that carefully. But I do recommend a good publicist and a good social network marketing person like Sherry Candler, who we work with, to help, you know, build your community and your fan base. That kind of thing is critical, not just within the industry, but to the audiences.
And I want to tell the listeners that Sherry Candler was a recent guest on the show. And if you want to learn more about Sherry, you should check her biography page at the interviews and listen to her interview here at Rex Sykes Movie Beat. She's an awesome guest. She knows her stuff. And you just heard from Orly, too, you know, that they utilize your services. So look into Sherry. We have about 4 minutes left. Orly, I just really kind of want to turn it over to you to close out with the last 4 minutes of whatever you think is important, and then we will pick this back up in the coming weeks. But I want you to have the final word in the next, you know, 4 or 5 minutes or so.
Oh, okay. The mission that we have at the Film Collaborative is really to help filmmakers find their way in the most safe and efficient manner possible. So our total goal is to make sense of the space as it changes, and it's changing so fast. I really, you know, anything that was written or discussed a year or two ago isn't current. There is a lot that was written about that, you know, still applies, but it's not current in terms of where the money's coming from in the digital space, which is constantly changing. And yet it's not all there is. There is a reason to still think about television sales, even though the prices have gone down. There is a need to sometimes license your rights because there's certain kinds of revenue streams that you're not going to tap into always on your own through a DIY model, and yet the DIY model is a really, really powerful model for you to follow and to plan for. And you could, if you've got the time, you've got to just figure out, do you have the time to invest in your own distribution career and your own business and allocate a year of your time to do that, or do you want to hire interns and have people like us or whomever else help you do that, but not necessarily your own time, or just have other people do all of it for you. But you've got to just get clear with yourself which kind of filmmaker you are, and know that you still have to be vested into your own distribution, even if you do license to some extent, because you're still going to need to be involved in order for that to work out well for you. Otherwise, you're going to get screwed over, and you can't just trust the distribution contracts that come your way. We really want to be available to filmmakers. We couldn't be any cheaper, but we would never turn someone away because of money. So there is no discussion that we can't have in terms of helping you in whatever way you need. We're really committed to that. That's the last thing I'm going to do in this business, before I hope to see it change completely such that we're no longer needed. I think that's
awesome.
It. Thank you.
Well, we have about 3 minutes left. But that is very cool.
Let me just talk about a couple features on our site, since I have three
yes,
minutes left.
Yes,
okay,
please.
I just want to. So it's the filmcollaborative.org, and .com also works. Filmmakers First also works as a website. On our site, there are a few features I'm really excited about. We have a distributor report card. Okay, so we have a page called Distripedia, and within that, there's the distributor report card where we school the distributors, and filmmakers are invited to comment on their experiences with distributors. And if you don't want to comment yourself, then you can contact us, send us what your thoughts are. We'll confirm things with you and write an anonymous comment. But the point is to, for free, have this information to help filmmakers get perspective on distributors. We have what we call our Facebook for Filmmakers, which is our social networking community, and the goal is to network filmmakers with each other so that they can be their own studio. If we gathered every filmmaker information under one roof and their contacts and their lists of who they did their non-theatrical and educational distribution through and all their NGOs that they worked with, if we gathered that all under one place and it was a commons space where filmmakers could share info, they wouldn't need distributors ever, except for maybe television deals. We have a digital distribution guide, which is trademark, which we've worked on for over a year and a half, or I was just saying about a year. And that's also part of Distripedia, but you can also find it on digitaldistributionguide.com. It is a wiki guide. We update it as much as we possibly can. We do ask people to be either a member or to donate a little something to see it, but just contact me and we'll discuss if you have any questions or want need to access it in another manner. We obviously have a distribution blog. And we do our daily distribution tidbits. So the point is, we're an educational resource, and we're trying to put up as much information on the site and keep it as current as possible for people to have access to on a yearly basis and to know that really the space is changing so frequently in terms of the kinds of opportunities available to filmmakers, the ones that they can access directly versus the ones that they can't, that they have to go through an aggregator for. Wanting to help you make sense of that so you can parse your rights and only give up rights when you kind of can't get to a revenue stream any other way. And I think that's the sort of the game that we're playing, the dance we have to dance right now, is to help filmmakers balance that whole aspect of when to license and when not to license. But those are some of the features on our site that I'm very, very proud of. We're a new organization, and we're going to keep checking back, and we keep adding to our board of advisors. We're making it more international. We really want to be
awesome.
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, we really are now about out of time. But you're just an absolute fountain of information and a wealth of critical information that you've been dispensing to people. I've got maybe about 60 seconds left, so I want to be able to say goodbye. But I want you to finish your thought.
Oh, no, I mean, I think that's about it. We just want to be – we're going to be the destination. We want to be the destination that has all the information that you might need, and that's our commitment to filmmakers. So I think that's it. I just realized I didn't really talk much about our site, so I wanted to finally get to that.
Well, Orly, I want to thank you so much for being here. We're going to have you back. Again, we'll let the listeners and the readers who are listening live, as well as those in the archives and those in the podcast, know when you're coming back. But thank you so very much.
You're so welcome. It was super fun to talk to you, and thank you for having your show.
All right, and we'll be in touch in just a few minutes. But thank you again.
You're welcome.
All right, that was Orly Ravid. Be sure to go to thefilmcollaborative.org and visit her website. We are out of time. I just want to say everybody have a fabulous day. Make your movies, complete your projects, and until we meet the next time, almost, be sure to tune into my upcoming guest. That is a wrap.